Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa seems to be fertile ground for poetry, with many poets all over the state bringing out new collections recently. Many poets participating in readings and slams. This hour, I'll talk to three Iowa poets who also teach at three different universities. We'll talk about writing, reading, teaching, and performing poetry. Also, creative ways to bring poetry to life. And first up this hour, Kyle McCord. He lives in Des Moines. He's the author most recently of X-Rays and Other Landscapes, his sixth collection. He teaches poetry and literature at Drake University and is very active in the poetry community. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And why don't you start us off by reading one of the poems in your latest collection? What would you like to read?
I think that I will read a poem about dental tools.
Okay.
It's a common theme in poetry, right?
Right.
So the backstory behind this is that while I was having my teeth cleaned, one of the folks who was working on that said, you know, it'd be really nice if the dental tools made like a different noise, like if they sang to you while they were doing this. And I thought, that's a brilliant idea. And I could only think it. I couldn't mouth it. Right.
Right.
So then in honor of that idea, I decided to write a poem about it. And this tells you, by the way, that if you say brilliant things around poets, we will instantly steal them. So something beautiful. If tools could make another noise, they should belt out show tunes, my dentist tells me. Less scraping, more Chicago. The drill echoing in the alley of your larynx could be cats, or the syncopated snaps of jets and sharks. Think how a scaler might deliver l'avant-ton du people, the pliers as French tenors, Inspector Javert's soliloquy playing in your mouth today, the ad could read. It's an idea so brilliant, someone must have already tried. Because what are we working for, if not more joy? To forget the busted skin and X-rays, the mechanical whine of this world. What mouth feels unnatural, filled with song, even if it's another voice, an unfamiliar machine, gifted the pipes of Astaire or Andrews, who could it reason surely would agree these hills are alive, the inflamed gums as clouds, the tongue dancing across like taps on marble, clacking in rhythm on the chorus, hitting the high notes.
That's Kyle McCord reading Something Beautiful from his most recent collection, X-Rays and Other Landscapes. Kyle, when did you first fall in love with poetry?
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of people imagine that, you know, perhaps someone, you know, goes on to be like an English major, and that leads them into a life of poetry in some way. That's not really how it worked for me. I studied Soviet and Chinese history as an undergraduate, and I almost got kicked out of my first poetry course when they figured out that I didn't have the prerequisites, and that made me so mad that I had to write 10 poems for my first poetry course, so I wrote 45 instead. And the binding quality of all of them was that they were pretty bad. but I wrote one that had some virtue to it. And my professor was, you know, very vocal about letting me know that. And that led me into, an internship where I worked for the Beloit Poetry Journal for the summer. But there was a great poem by Robert Bly that we read in class that talked about the way in which animals fall in love, and it's kind of a breakup poem. I don't think I really realized it at the time, but that's really it's a poem called "Listening to the Cologne Concert," and I'd always, you know, wanted to make something beautiful, right? I always had been someone who wanted to be creative, but I was really bad at music, you know. I was bad at lots of other things. But it turned out poetry was something that I realized the harder I worked at it, the more it seemed to pay out. But at the same time, it was a real challenge, and I liked that. And so somewhere between those aspects of beauty and then also just the fact that it was challenging, I sort of got more and more enamored. And I will say that, like all great love relationships, the more years I participated in it, the more I sort of fall in.
So this wasn't something that you came to as a reader?
I had read, Rilke. I had read, some Bly before that. I had read some sort of classical texts. You know, one of the features of poetry is that a lot of times it's taught in classrooms, but unlike other things where you might get, if you turn on the radio to a pop station or something like that, you can hear like the latest pop music, right? Most poetry that's taught is from 50 or 60 years ago or more, right? And so a lot of the, new and innovative things that that are happening in the world of poetry, you might not have ever heard of, right? I had some idea as a reader, but for me now, reading is a very intimate part of my process. In that, I read, between poems, while I'm writing a poem, I'll go look at this line or that line, and I'll say, "Oh, I really want to make that sound. How can I make that happen?" You know, in many ways, it's like music. You hear something and you think, "Oh, I really would love to see if I could do that."
Is it kind of exciting to you to think about the fact that it sounds like it was this connection made in the classroom that really awakened the poet in you, and here you are teaching?
Yes. So I mentioned all of the things in that I wasn't good at along the way, and I'm very pleased to say that teaching is something that I absolutely love. I was telling Paul this morning that almost all of my students in my intro to poetry class are studying actuarial science, and I am.
What a poetic field!
I know, right? Well, yes, absolutely. And the thing is, it actually, it lends itself to a particular kind of expertise. One of the things that really delights me about poetry is the range of things that can be appropriated into it. I tell people a lot of times, look, the more anti-poetic you think something is, the more you can write yourself into a corner, the more fun it is to get out, right? I want to read a poem that tries to make the science, the actuary, I don't even know enough about it to say exactly what aspect of it would be beautiful, but I'd love to see how actuarial science could be a beautiful thing on the page. And, many of my poems deal with, Soviet and Chinese history, or, I attended seminary, and so they deal with the appearance of Hebrew on the page. As a teacher, one of my big fascinations is how can we take these very disparate experiences, and this should be an encouragement to listeners too, that we can take these incredibly disparate experiences, and a lot of times there's something that haven't been mined yet. People haven't thought of how to make that a beautiful or incredible or an experience that has an epiphany in some way. As an instructor, it's pretty exciting to get to, extend the kind of generosity that was extended to me as a student.
I want to talk a little bit about your most recent collection, X-rays and Other Landscapes, as we'll talk about this hour, some very different poetry collections. Every poetry collection, it seems, is very different. But
yeah.
You just read us a poem about sitting in a dentist chair and thinking about the beautiful sounds that dental equipment could make. But there is an overarching theme in this collection that kind of ties things together. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I write a lot of poems using what's called an ekphrastic lens. An ekphrastic lens is I use art as a binding feature. My wife's a visual artist, and so we have had lots of conversations about this. And I write also in persona. You know, there's no certainty with a poem that the I voice is the speaker. It's not like nonfiction or something like that. And so a few years ago, I started writing poems about a son who's struggling with the death of his father, or the impending death of his father from cancer. And my father is alive and well, thankfully. But, you know, I'd had some family experience with this. And so I wanted to talk about those relationships of fathers and sons. And so many of the poems attempt to deal with the struggles of a family member dying of cancer through the lens of art. You know, one of the, if you were to, I think, survey poets, perhaps the most, like, number one most common sort of theme in poetry is death in some way. But the question is how you approach it, right? How do you engage it in a way that says something that other people haven't necessarily said before? So the way that I came at it was, let's take these x-rays and think about how they're also beautiful. They're also landscapes. They're also all these various other things. And in some ways, that becomes a way for the speaker to wrestle with these issues of sickness and impatience and general, you know, coming to sort of some kind of conclusion about this very difficult relationship with his father.
Well, and there is this overarching theme, but there's not a narrative arc really through the poem. So I'm curious about how you bring those themes together. How do you know a poem belongs in this collection, is part of this?
It's a great question. And I think it has to do with a theory that I'm borrowing from a poet named Alan Michael Parker. So part of my work is also as an editor for Gold Lake Press. And so we talk a lot about the three-dimensionality of a book, which is not only how does an individual poem speak on the page, but how does it speak to the last poem? How does the first word in the book speak to the last word in the book? How do the various elements that are bonded together speak to each other, right? And so when I look and thought about, okay, what are the features that are going to bind this? I looked a lot at how is this show personal growth for the speaker?
And originally, I think we're going to have to pick up that thread in just a moment. I'm talking with poet Kyle McCord. We're talking about his most recent collection, X-Rays and Other Landscapes. We'll bring more poets into the conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with three different Iowa poets. And coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Jennifer Knox and then Paul Brook. Right now with me, Kyle McCord. He lives in Des Moines and is the author most recently of X-Rays and Other Landscapes. It's his sixth collection. He teaches poetry and literature at Drake University and is very active in the poetry community. And Kyle, I interrupted you mid-thought to take that break, unfortunately. But we were about how there's an overarching theme to your collection, X-Rays and Other Landscapes, about a son dealing with his father's cancer diagnosis and the fact that this is a terminal diagnosis. But it's not overt. It's not a narrative thread like you would find in an essay or something fictional. But you were talking about how you find the threads that connect these different poems to each other.
Yes. And I think with all of these collections that you're going to hear from these very talented folks, there's always some sort of guiding, connective voice that's at the core of it, right? An I speaker that's sort of clutch. That's a great recommendation for folks who are checking out books of poetry, which is to think about the ways in which not only is there some sort of, like, we would call it like a teleology, which means that it moves from sort of point A to point B, C, D. Instead, it's moving over between the first poem and the last poem. So when I thought about what should go into this book, what I really thought was, okay, there's like a tone this is establishing, and there's an experience that goes beyond just the physical moment of being in the waiting room or being in the any sort of biopsy room, right? These are all things, so everything that's collected in here are features of that life leading into those kind of moments. And you're absolutely right. It isn't a narrative thread as much as it is a thematic thread. One of the great virtues of poetry is that it's able to express not merely what happened, but the feeling of what is happening, the experience of being there that's captured by all these minutiae, whether it's thinking about a scene from The Shining or, working through the idea of a moon disaster. So to me, all of these things are interconnected as forms of experience that I then wanted to share with the reader.
Why don't you read us one more poem? You selected A Guide to Falling Downstairs.
So this is the final poem in the book. And unfortunately, this one does have some nonfiction elements. But I'm fine now, not to worry.
So, good, good.
A Guide to Falling Downstairs. You'll need dollar store flip-flops. The shabbier, the better. You'll need a black Glad bag, a busted porch light. You'll want a fine char on the cutlets, so set the burner to high before you step onto the porch. Listen to it simper, the cicada's fulmination like meat spitting in cast iron. They are mallets, planishing an unseen anvil. You'll want to savor this because what follows is terrible. Descending, elbow to cement, toenails wrenched on the rails down to the frozen bottom, and nothing to do there but wail to the 1 a.m. stars who might have been regal but for this wound. You are Sisyphus, shoving the cumbersome boulder of your body against the iron rail. What a relief, somehow, to watch bruises fan out like ink on rice paper. Finally, a pain you can touch. Think of your father, miles away, a maze of cables and drips. His lungs swell with fluid no doctor can show you, can't spoon out. And if you really listen, they are not mallets, but a heart monitor that you measure against your own and must somehow live on, rise up, and ascend.
Kyle McCord reading from his latest collection, X-Rays and Other Landscapes. And Kyle, stay with us, but now I want to bring Jennifer Knox into the conversation. Her most recent collection is Days of Shame and Failure. Her forthcoming collection is Crushing It, which will be out in the fall of 2020. She teaches at Iowa State University, and you may be familiar with her Iowa Bird of Mouth project. We talked about it on Talk of Iowa a couple years ago. She developed and curated the Crowdsourced Poetry Project in 2016 and 2017. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Charity.
Well, thank you for being here. And you brought a couple of poems from Crushing It, which we won't get our hands on until 2020. But Why don't you start us off by reading one of those poems?
Okay. This one combines my love of Irwin Allen, who is the master of disaster movies, and Lion Tamers. And listening to Kyle speak about how a poem is created, I thought I should say that for many years I have been carrying around in my brain a scene from an Errol Morris documentary called Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. And it was the person in the documentary who was a lion tamer and why he became a lion tamer. And he had grown up watching Clyde Beatty movies at the down the street from where he lived. And he loved Clyde Beatty. And he said, back then, we didn't know who would win in a battle of man versus nature. And I thought, yes, that's indeed why people became lion tamers. And I've been looking for a poem to put it in. And Irwin Allen and the Lion Tamer lined up.
Nice.
And this is called Irwin Allen versus the Lion Tamer. We used to love lion tamers because people really didn't know who would win in a battle of man versus nature. Back then, all the stories ended in death, our death, by mauling or snake bite or dog bite or being struck by lightning, smothered by an avalanche, charged off a cliff, carried away in the talons of an eagle, inhaled by a whale, stung by a scorpion, swarmed by killer bees, gored by a rhino, poisoned by berries, pricked by a sticker, swallowed by quicksand, beguiled by a black cat, gobbled by a witch. So imagine the relief with one flick of the whip and an up. The skulking lion stands on legs like a human. Its toothy protest, no big thing. After all those years of fear, I'd laugh at it too. And that's what people did till there were no more lions to laugh at. But Irwin Allen knew that death doesn't live in a thing you can kill with a gun. It's not the heat, it's the hubris. The fire that wipes the city out begins in birthday candles and the happy huff behind them. The storm that flips the cruise ship starts in the sea that rises up to fill the empty sky. An airplane crash begins not in birds, but in the feeders we've stolen the seed from. Certain nobody can see us.
That's Jennifer Knox reading Irwin Allen versus the Lion Tamer. It will be out in 2020 in the book Crushing It from Copper Canyon Press. And Jennifer, tell me when you first fell in love with poetry.
Well, like Kyle, I did not come to it through any of my earlier English classes. Poetry wasn't even taught in my high school. And my first poetry class in college, I did not go very much, and I failed it. So I am a poet who failed her first poetry class. And that was just a reading class. I fell in love with it when I started to write it. And for me, I've heard writing poetry described as a more mental pursuit, but for me, it's very physical, and it starts in the body, and there is it's almost like playing tennis, but you're playing against yourself, and it's a puzzle that you create and only you can solve. And it is that engagement with my own brain that draws out a very physical response in me. And then reading my work in front of people that's a completely different skill, I think, and yet equally exciting. So I fell in love with it when I started to write it for classes.
And do you feel like there are things you can express in poetry that you just could not express in any other way?
Absolutely. I have heard poetry described as the language of dreams, the pre-verbal language. And unlike any other art form, music, visual art, fiction writing, in poetry you can switch from one subject to another so fast. You can even do it in the middle of a word. You can start to morph into something else. So we don't have to see the whole shape before the shape changes into something else. And I think poetry can express that expediency in thought, almost like a cartoon.
Does a poem mean something different when you read it or when you perform it than when it's laying there on the page?
Well, normally I would say it's the same poem, but I have been told by friends that everything sounds very different when it's coming out of my mouth. So I would like to say it's its own little animal, it has its own little life, but apparently when we turn it on through voices, I can change what people think it's about.
Well, you know, when I read poetry, a lot of the time when I read poetry, I read it out loud because mm-hmm. it feels like something that should be read to me. Do you read poetry out loud to yourself, other people's poetry?
I don't. Perhaps if I come across a couple of lines that are just so chunky and good that I have to, I tell my students that reading it aloud is turning on the machine. So I'm sure there have been lines that are just so incredible that I have to turn them on and say them to myself. I have birds. I have two lovebirds and a parakeet, and they love to hear poetry read to them.
So they get excited when they hear it?
They know that something special is happening, that this is not ordinary chit-chat.
Do they speak? Do any of them speak?
No. They shriek.
Okay.
Quite a bit.
I can imagine a parrot learning a line of Edgar Allan Poe
sure.
or something, and that would be good.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read another poem for us?
Sure. Speaking of motifs that stretch across the book, one subject that I wrote a lot about for the new book is our true crime stories. And this is about the Golden State Killer. And I wrote this before he was identified, and I have a little epigraph. The Golden State Killer stole trophies from his victims, such as flatware, jewelry, photographs, and driver's licenses. 20 years after his crime spree had stopped, police began to release lists of all the items in hopes that someone, a family member, a home health aide, and so forth, would recognize an item and report the owner, who would then be in his 80s. In a statement to the public, a detective said, "So if you find a drawer full of driver's licenses at your uncle's house, call us." And this is called Finding a Drawer Full of Driver's Licenses. All expired, mostly women in their 30s when the photos were taken. Now they'd be in their 60s and 70s. A few men frowning under uneven mustaches, some faces scratched out to white blurs in the plastic. How funny was fashion back then? Pointy collars, wide as windsocks, all that argyle, hard hair, and eyeglasses so thick. Why, it'd be like peering out of a freezer through the narrowing window of ice. Back then, nothing defrosted itself. We babysat our appliances, untethered their thick black cords from the walls, and waited till the water ran off wherever it wanted. Unmarked Tupperware and ice trays left behind.
Finding a Drawer Full of Driver's Licenses, again from the forthcoming collection, Crushing It, by Jennifer Knox. And Jennifer, you stay with us. I want to bring Paul Brook into the conversation now. Paul Brook, his most recent book is Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair. He teaches at Grandview University in Des Moines. He's also a photographer, and in the summer of 2018 was awarded a 2-week residency in Iceland to create banished photographs and poems of Iceland. Hello, Paul.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks for being here. And why don't you start us off by reading one of your poems?
Okay. Well, I'm going to read from the title poem, Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair. And I have a couple of things to describe before I begin.
Okay.
One, I did compete at the Iowa State Fair in arm wrestling and did it for quite a few years. And so the poem comes from that experience. So you don't always have to make it up, but you can experience it.
Seems like a dig.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize,
showing
Kyle.
Off a little bit there.
I'm
okay.
Sorry. No, it's all good. And the other thing is I'm using lots of unusual words, so the collection is really a way to keep these words from going extinct. There are words in our language that, because of various reasons, we just don't use them. They're either complicated or strange or whatever. Well, we're all complicated and strange. So here are some of the words you might want to know. As I read the poem, lant is stale urine, clauscrun is an old tree used as a rubbing post, euph is a quiet muffled bark, inhume means to bury, callology means to study beauty, a quiddler is a person who hangs out at work wasting time, vespertine is occurring in the evening, gerbil is to spill a liquid, pickthank is a yes person, and pseudoandria is giving a female a male name. So.
Okay.
Here we go. It's a lot. Sorry.
There will be a quiz.
There will not be a quiz, but that will help you, maybe.
All right.
This is arm wrestling at the Iowa State Fair. He misses no detail as he enters the cattle barn. It drifts with lant and sawdust. Contestants quietly file in and are weighed in. Farm hands with forearms like cause crunts. Gym rats with biceps rolled up. Journeymen with sausage casing fingers. And burly women with names like Mel and Charlie. He analyzes arm wrestling, the raw, unmuddled energy of body against body, lever against lever. He studies demeanor, conditioning, and discipline. There are pickthanks, doubters, quiddlers, BSers, and pure cocky. Some are buried even before they begin, wide-eyed. You broke someone's arm? He's pinned already. Some are drinking beer after the weigh-in. Oh, they'll garble their words as evening approaches, and they're through. Some rage in a corner, oof and yelp as they strain. But it's the quiet foreboders he watches for, drawing inward, zen-like, yogified. Those worry his arm.
Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair by Paul Brook from his most recent collection, Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Paul Brook teaches at Grandview University in Des Moines. He's also a photographer. Jennifer Knox is here. Her most recent collection is Days of Shame and Failure. She teaches at Iowa State University. And Kyle McCord, his most recent collection is X-rays and Other Landscapes. He teaches poetry and literature at Drake University. And we'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with three different Iowa poets. Kyle McCord is here from Des Moines. His most recent collection is X-rays and Other Landscapes. He teaches poetry and literature at Drake University. Jennifer Knox is here. She lives in Nevada, and her most recent collection is Days of Shame and Failure. She teaches at Iowa State University. And Paul Brook is here. His most recent collection is Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair, and he teaches at Grandview University in Des Moines. And Paul, just before the break, you read your title poem from your collection, Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair, and I think Kyle was accusing you of showing off because you were an arm wrestler as well. tell me, I've asked both Jennifer and Kyle, so I want to know, when did you first fall in love with poetry?
Well, I was an undergraduate biology major at Iowa State, and I took a class with Mary Swander, and I thought I was a good poet. I was not. But she saw like a spark in me, and so I started writing more poetry, and then I think she invited me to a graduate class, and I started just realizing that I had the talent to do it, and then I went on to get my master's and my PhD in English. It was sort of very strange that one class sort of changed the trajectory of my life, but there was something about poetry that was, I think, cathartic, and also it gave me revelation, and it also showed me that my brain could actually synthesize all these parts into one moving entity. And that was the exciting part for me. Like, that's what I think the creative process was something I was missing. I think science, I love science, and I still use science when I write. Like, this book is really studying language and 400 words that are falling out of favor. So it's like, I like the research, but then I like the emotional release of becoming a character, or, you know, feeling something emotional like what Kyle went through, or realizing something from a newspaper, as Jennifer was reading. You take these things and pull them together, and they create something that it shocks you and surprises you and transcends time and space.
You are also a photographer. Is there a relationship between photography and poetry?
Oh, absolutely. I'm driven by image, and you could probably feel that or sense that when I'm reading it. Like, I'm trying to deliver you a set of images. And so photography for me is like the perfect complement to it. So a lot of times, some of my collections, it's funny, I'll actually photograph things first, and then I most of the time the books are both photography and poetry. So I'm doing it either one of two ways. I'm writing the poems and then photographing them. I did some of that in Iceland. And then other times I'm photographing and then writing poems to complement them. So to me, the image is driving everything for me.
Interesting. And does it... the way that a poem can capture an emotion or express an emotion, do you feel like photographs are similarly cathartic, or is a poem a way to express what you see?
A poem expresses what you feel. A photograph, that's an interesting question. A photograph does it at a different level than, say, a poem does. There's so many layers to a poem. in terms of language, but there are so many layers to the way a photograph is created. So, for example, if you're thinking about, oh, I'm going to use this particular technique in poetry, a metaphor or whatever, and maybe it's lighting in a photograph. So you're figuring out all the different aspects to make sure that that photograph is the best it can be, and you're making sure that all the techniques are laid out properly in the poem so it can be the best it can be. So they're very similar in that respect, but they can have different impacts on the viewer. So it's, yeah, I guess they're related, but they're different experiences.
I would love for you to read another poem, and you actually picked my favorite from your collection. So okay. Read that for us.
Okay, so the title of the poem is "The Look Between Two People in Which Each Loves the Other, But Each Is Afraid to Make the First Move." And this is a word, mamala pineapple a pie. I'm not making this up. And the word is from Tierra del Fuego, and it's the most specific word in language, according to the Guinness World Book of Records, which, you know, they're really tops at what they do. It's a little bit sarcastic, but whatever. So this is the look between two people who are in love but afraid to make the first move. "The two are tightrope walkers strung on parallel courses, soft-shoeing the thin edge, briefly glancing, swallowing despair, abject terror. Both fear, the suspension bridge strung of rope, looming like a mortgage. She is a storefront display, quarantined by glass, like a peacock surrounded by a fence, like a meacock or a dunce. The audience stops and points, shooting them scorn. He pauses, too afraid to fall into the thrill. Looking up, he sees the ledge's lip, curved like a hook. He's so close. Why this? Why not a contortionist, a sarwan, a lion tamer? Would he be braver? Would she approve? Both step away, never plunging from the safety of their wires."
That is Paul Brook reading the poem, "The Look Between Two People in Which Each Loves the Other, But Each Is Afraid to Make the First Move." That's from his collection, Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair. What's the word again, Paul? Say it one more time.
Mamala pineapple a pie.
All right. I've been
practicing it for days.
well done to you. And I want to bring all three of you into the conversation again. I have Paul Brook, Kyle McCord, and Jennifer Knox here with me. And it's so interesting to me that all of you fell in love with poetry really in your college years. I interviewed Billy Collins a few years ago, and that was one of his big complaints about education, that poetry is sort of taught in such a dead way in our junior highs and high schools as something that students need to get through. And he wants to, of course, bring poetry more into our everyday lives and get people excited about it. I'm curious, and just jump in and tell me, what do you think we should be doing to bring poetry alive for people who don't wind up in Mary Swander's class? And since she's retired, that's not going to happen. But what should we be doing to bring poetry to life?
Well, the good news is there are, and this is directly to your readers, y'all, there are so many great opportunities to hear poetry and to get involved in poetry and to write poetry, right? So I agree with Billy Collins insofar as I think sometimes when poetry is put out for folks when they're younger, it's presented as sort of a rubric, you know, a Rubik's Cube, right? Like, oh, you got to solve this
and
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's not fun.
No.
Right? Yeah, it's not fun.
Not fun.
It's not fun if you, because, and so a lot of people, I think the biggest fear that I've noticed from people coming into poetry readings is they're like, oh, I have to get some particular experience out of it. No, there are so many ranges of music, so many ways in which you can enjoy poetry. So, in fact, Beaverdale Books, which is our lovely local bookstore here. I know you guys are out in Iowa City, too. You got Prairie Lights. Mm-hmm. So many great readings happen weekly at Prairie Lights, practically daily, right? We have a poetry karaoke night coming up on, I believe, it's April 14th at 6 o'clock, where we'll each be sharing some poems by other authors. So you can get in, you can get involved that way. There are lots of local poetry groups. The Iowa Poetry Society every year has a gathering of folks at all different levels. So I would say that we'll always be out here reading poems, right? And so I think that what I would love for your readers to, or your listeners, sorry, I'm so used to being a poet.
They know.
Yeah, right. is just like you don't have to reach out far into the world in order to hear some of these wonderful poems that these guys are putting together.
Well, and Jennifer, I know, I mean, we talked before about your crowdsourced poetry mm-hmm. project, which really, I think, introduced a lot of people to the idea of, oh, hey, I can write poetry, too. I'm curious, what are your thoughts?
The Iowa Bird of Mouth Project, over 750 people from around the world contributed lines to those poems. For every month, there was a different bird. And I chose birds as the subject for it because I saw that Iowans seemed to have an affinity for wild birds in a way that I had not experienced in any other state. I think Iowans have a wild bird love that exceeds all other states.
That sounds like us. That's
yes, it does. When your manicurist tells you that she always stops to look at cardinals because they're the incarnated spirit of her departed grandmother, you have to listen to, as a poet, that's a big thing. You have to take that to heart. I learned doing that project, what I learned was that poetry, unlike almost any other, I can't think of another way in which we use language that is like poetry, because poetry has a side to make us feel. It doesn't have a purpose. It's not meant to give us instructions. The information we get out of it is very subjective. Now, some people are not comfortable with that level of subjectivity in their language. So I recommend that those people continue to avoid poetry at all costs. For the people who want to engage with it, as Kyle said, there are so many community groups. And I think that's where I really lucked out, is when I went to get my master's, I met a community that I've carried with me for my entire life. And those communities have never been more accessible now that people are online and sharing poems and forums all over the world.
Well, and Paul, I don't know when exactly Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair was released. I think bringing poetry to the state fair is probably a great way to get people engaged. Have you done a reading at the Iowa State Fair?
I have not, but I think what I should do is like arm wrestle people and read at the same time. It'd be very exciting.
And what's the word for that?
I don't have a word for it yet. Probably painful would be the word. I would probably beat them all, though, still. But whatever.
See, Paul made fun of the Guinness Book of World Records, but you're in the book Guinness Book of World Records, are you not?
No, I'm not. I have a world record for deadlifting, for
deadlifting,
for powerlifting.
But
I'm not that.
I see where the scoring comes from. This is a competitive thing. All right, I get it.
It's true.
I could see you getting into the Guinness Book of World Records for reading poems and arm wrestling people.
I think that could be a new category.
Yeah.
No one knows.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you won't know until you try it.
That's right.
But, you know, we have this email, and this is one you've heard it from many other people. This one's from Carl. He says, I object to what's called poetry nowadays. Real poetry has rhythm and rhyme. The newspaper poets of the 19th century are the best. They would never compose the mental ramblings which take little talent passed off as poetry nowadays. Putting some prose into a column of sorts to make it look like a poem doesn't make it poetry. Poetry with rhythm and rhyme takes talent. All right. So
okay, what does he really think?
Right. Carl was
tell us what you really think.
A little blunt there. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you've all heard that when, you know, Kyle, you mentioned that so much of the poetry that we teach in school is older poetry. And a lot of it is in these very specific structures, because that's part of what's taught about poetry is, oh, here are these different kinds of poems. But most of the poetry written these days doesn't fall into those categories. So respond to Carl and the other doubters out there.
Yeah. Well, Carl definitely has some strong feelings. And look, this in no way is to say.
And his email was kind of a poem in and of itself.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I think he would object to that.
I heard the rhyme scheme in
that. Yeah, I think he would. Maybe we need to go back and check if it's a sonnet. Maybe he had some slant rhymes.
Yeah.
Well, one of the fundamental things we can say is this. American poetry has always been deviant in the way that it's gone about things. From even Dickinson, right, who is seemingly using a very formal structure, is undermining it and playing with it. And what I would say is this fundamentally. Rhyme is an incredible form of music when it's utilized in these clever ways. And I can name you four or five great, you know, formal poems, you know, Trinity by Bruce Bond or First Poem for You by Kim Adonisio, right? There's no shortage of great formal poetry out there, and I would be remiss to discourage anyone from going and finding it. Dana Gioia has a giant collection of it. But here's the other thing. There are so many sounds that are available in the world and forms of figurative language and ways in which you can use syntax on the page and line breaks and these other features of poetry that to say, well, this is the great truth of poetry and all others must follow from it, I think is missing out on something. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that, oh, you can't enjoy formal poetry. Of course you can, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't like to eat just one flavor of ice cream, mm-hmm. right? I don't like to just hear one song over and over again. And to me, all of those forms of poetry do beautiful things, but they also miss out on opportunities in the same way that other forms of poetry might miss out on those opportunities.
And I'd add to that, I mean, I think Carl has a point. Like, I still think you need to know what formalism is. You need to, I feel for myself, I've written and I've tried all the different forms. I've written in...
You often write in form.
Yeah, yeah. I do it all the time. And so I think a lot of us have like this kind of background that allows us to do that. And then we will break free of it. But that doesn't mean I don't really enjoy it or think it's worthwhile. The other problem is, and my students have this problem, is they want to rhyme, and then what it does is causes cliche.
Yep. Mm.
And cliche, I don't want to read that again. I've seen it 1,000 times. So, you know, Carl, my fear is that people in the world will use rhyme as a mechanism and create cliche. What I want to do is say something new and fresh. So what I'm doing is pushing the envelope. Now, I can still write a villanelle.
Right.
I can write an iamb. I can do trochee. I can do the whole thing. But I also can do the other. So, you know, I think you have to be careful. And I want to be diverse. I want to try to do as much as I can. And if you want to read formal poets, they're out there. And if you want to go to formal readings, they're out there. You can find them. You can.
Well, I mean... Yeah. And I think Pollock was a great figure painter before he was ever an action
yes.
artist.
Yeah, and he became the artist he became because that art was born. Mm-hmm. You can't unbirth a movement or a mode of thinking. It'd be like saying, well, we only listen to John Philip Sousa marches forever.
Right.
Like, that's all I listen to.
We can work a tuba into anything. Right?
That's actually the name of Jennifer's
next
book after
collection,
Crushing
right.
It. Yeah,
working a tuba into it?
Working a tuba into it.
More tuba.
More tuba.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charity.
Thank you.
I was talking with Kyle McCord, who lives in Des Moines. He's the author most recently of X-Rays and Other Landscapes. That's his sixth collection. He teaches poetry and literature at Drake University. Jennifer Knox, her most recent collection is Days of Shame and Failure. Her forthcoming collection is Crushing It, which will be out in the fall of 2020. She teaches at Iowa State University. And Paul Brook was also here. His most recent book is Arm Wrestling at the Iowa State Fair, and he teaches at Grandview University in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.